Morning, may it please the court. The trial judge in this case committed two reversible errors during jury deliberations. First, he gave an anti-deadlock instruction under circumstances that created an unacceptable risk that the holdout juror or jurors acquiesced in the guilty verdict as a result of coercion. Second, he communicated with the jury after its second deadlock note and ultimately gave the Thomas anti-deadlock instruction, all in Mr. Lloyd's absence.
Can I ask you, before you get started, do we know how much time elapsed between the time the court got the second note, that is the note that he sealed, and he talks to the lawyers, Lloyd is gone, he brings the jury in, he chews them out about telling the number. He sends them out again, brings them back in again, and gives them the Thomas charge. And that we know was at 4:38, but do we know how much time had elapsed? I'm just trying to figure out how long Lloyd was gone. Do we know that?
We don't know exactly, Your Honor. It appears that the proceedings following the second deadlock note lasted about 21 minutes from the time that the judge reconvened the lawyers before reconvening the jury the second time until the time that the judge gave the Thomas instruction.
All right, do we know, for instance, if his lawyer could have rounded him up? In other words, there was a period of time between the time the judge called the jury in and said, you weren't supposed to do that, sent them back, and then called them in again to give them the Thomas deadlock charge. Isn't that right?
Well, actually, Judge, I don't think the trial judge sent the jury back the second time after admonishing them about disclosing their split. I think they remained in the jury room, and the judge then asked the foreperson what else was contained in the note. At that point, the foreperson requested some re-instructions. The judge re-instructed them, and as part of that, re-instruction gave the Thomas charge. Did have a bench conference before doing that.
Okay, so the bench conference was with the jury in the room?
That's my understanding of the record, Your Honor. And we don't know, the record is unclear as to where Mr. Lloyd was, other than his lawyer apparently said he was downstairs. The judge assumed that meant he was in the cafeteria, but there's having a drink, a soda or something, but there's no specific record evidence on that point. There's no indication in the record that the defense counsel attempted to contact Mr. Lloyd.
And Lloyd was there for the first?
He was there for the first, yes, he was there for the proceedings following the first deadlock note.
Did he return to the courtroom after this happened?
He did, Your Honor.
He did, okay.
At some point.
So do we know when he became aware that there was a proceeding in his absence? Did he know it when he returned on that day?
We don't know, Your Honor. The record is just silent on that point. As to the first error, there were a combination of circumstances that rendered the Thomas charge coercive. First, there were two deadlock notes. The first one indicated that the jury was, quote, close quote, to reaching a verdict, but needed, quote, encouragement. The judge reconvened the jury in the courtroom, confirmed that they were close, that their note indicated they were close to reaching a verdict, and told the jurors that the judge was there to give them the requested encouragement. The timing of the two notes, there was a very short...
Well, he gave them the partial verdict.
And he gave them the partial verdict instruction, Your Honor, yes.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
The second deadlock note came right on the heels of the first one. We can't tell exactly from the record how long a period elapsed, but the second note was certainly less than 30 minutes after the first note. Deliberations resumed after the first note at 4 o'clock, and by 4:38, the judge had reconvened the jury after the second note. So he'd received the second note, started to read it, stopped reading it, ordered that it be sealed, reconvened the lawyers, had some discussion with the lawyers, and then reconvened the jury. So it's fair to assume from this record that the second note came fairly quickly after the first one. And by doing that, it kept some pressure on the holdout jurors. The second note, of course, contained the numerical split. And the judge told the jury that he had noticed that the note contained their division on each count, but had not read it, had stopped reading the note at that point. It's certainly possible that some of the holdout jurors, or holdout juror, we don't know how many there were somewhat skeptical of that explanation by the judge.
Well, he did, he went overboard to say, I have not looked at the number, you were not supposed to tell me that.
He did, Your Honor.
The point is that
in terms of measuring the coercion, we have to look at, the cases are clear that we have to look at it from the perspective of the holdout juror or jurors. So it's possible, although again unclear from the record, what reaction the holdout jurors would have had when the judge said, I noticed that your note contained a split, you weren't supposed to do that as I had instructed you, but I stopped reading and I don't know how you're divided.
He was emphatic, I averted my eyes.
Certainly, we have to take him at his word, there's no question.
So I'm asking again, wouldn't we have to say that a holdout juror just didn't believe him or was skeptical?
Your Honor. Okay. The foreperson's request for re-instructions after the second note were clearly directed toward the holdouts, and in fairly critical or pejorative language, the foreperson asked for re-instructions because a juror or jurors were not refusing to deliberate. Those weren't the foreperson's words. Said we're creating evidence, or creating their own evidence, their own fantasy. And that was done in open court. The judge did not, after the second deadlock note, the judge did not instruct the jury to go back and write another note as to what additional requests, if any, they had made in the second note. Instead, all of these proceedings were conducted in open court. And then ultimately, the judge gave a Thomas instruction, sua sponte. Neither side requested it. Both lawyers seemed to indicate that the duty to deliberate instruction was the appropriate instruction to give, and the judge proceeded to give the Thomas instruction. So that combination of circumstances had possibly a coercive effect on the holdout jurors, and that's the standard.
Can I ask a question about that?
Certainly.
So as far as I could read of these cases that talk about the anti-deadlock instruction coming after finding out about the split, none of them involve a Thomas instruction. They all involve an Allen charge.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are there any that involve a Thomas? Is there any case where we've held, or I guess anybody who uses something like the ABA charge, has said that when you issue a Thomas charge after learning of the split, that that's coercive?
We didn't find any cases on that.
The reason I ask it is, in Thomas, the court was looking for something that was not coercive rather than Allen, which was coercive. And when you look at the Thomas charge, it's kind of hard to look at that and thinking about it as being coercive. Even with respect to the holdout jurors, it specifically says, do not surrender honest conviction, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea that when you learn about a split and then issue an Allen charge, yes, I understand the argument that cause could be coercive. But in this case, you have to help me a little bit more on understanding how it could be coercive. I understand that if you poll the jurors and ask them, but in this situation where it's at the best ambiguous whether the jurors thought he knew.
Yes, Judge.
And then you come up with a non-coercive charge. Where's the coercion?
Well, our position, Your Honor, is that the coercion results from the combination of circumstances, not just the Thomas instruction, but the request by the foreperson in open court in which he or she used pejorative language concerning the holdout.
So wouldn't that also apply, would that also apply to the partial verdict or the duty to deliberate or any of those instructions? I mean, basically what you're saying is any instruction that follows that kind of thing might be read by the holdouts as being coercive.
No, Your Honor, that's not our position. The Thomas instruction certainly is not as coercive as the court said as the Allen charge, however, does contain language that the jurors that are reconsider their views and consider the views of the other jurors. And to that extent, given the other circumstances
but
here.
But immediately thereafter says, but do not surrender your own
honest
views.
Convictions.
Right.
It certainly is more neutral than the Allen charge, Your Honor. That apparently occurred even before the first note, Your Honor, because the first note indicated that the jury was hung on three counts.
On 1, 2, and 4.
Yes, Your Honor. If I could skip quickly over to the second point having to do with Mr. Lloyd's right to be present during these proceedings. Mr. Lloyd had both a constitutional right and a right under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 43. To be present during all of the proceedings following the second deadlock note.
Mr. Jaffe, if we accept that, or at least for purposes of argument, and focus just for the moment on the whether there was prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
What can you flesh out what the prejudice would be?
The prejudice here, Your Honor, resulted from several different factors. One, the critical stage of the proceedings. Involving the giving of an anti-deadlock instruction after two deadlock notes.
But you just said that the judge gave it sua sponte. So
yes,
I guess the question is what could, I mean, in at least one of the Supreme Court opinions, Gagnon, I think, the court says that there was nothing could have been done. That is, nothing that the defendant would have said would have made any difference. What could the defendant have said here that his counsel was there?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I'm not raising the issue about waiver, but given that his counsel was there, what could he have said, especially, and given that it was sua sponte, what could he have done?
He could have consulted with his lawyer before the judge gave the Thomas instruction. There was a colloquy between the judge and counsel as to what was the appropriate response to the jury's to the foreperson's requests and the second deadlock note, and Mr. Lloyd could have consulted with his lawyer, could have had a different reaction to the juror to the foreperson's requests,
and told his lawyer to object to the Thomas chart?
To argue more strenuously. Our position is that he did object to the Thomas instruction by stating that the duty to deliberate instruction was the appropriate one, but clearly that was not a vigorous instruction, did not clearly articulate the coercive nature of the Thomas instruction given the other circumstances. So Mr. Lloyd perhaps could have consulted with his lawyer about the response to the jury questions. Mr. Lloyd was absent during those entire proceedings in terms of prejudice also. It was a lengthy proceeding, even though when the judge told the jury that Mr. Lloyd was downstairs and they were going to proceed without him because this was going to be very brief, it wasn't very brief. It was a 21-minute procedure, a proceeding, and Mr. Lloyd was absent throughout.
And you don't fault his own lawyer for not saying, let me go get him? You know, his lawyer said, I'll waive his presence.
I do fault his lawyer for that, Your Honor. We did not raise this in the context of an ineffectiveness claim. However, certainly I believe his lawyer had a duty to at least ask the court for permission to locate Mr. Lloyd and advise him of the proceedings. Also, in terms of prejudice, this was a close case. There were two deadlock notes. And the standard applied by this court has been whether there's a reasonable possibility of prejudice. And based on this record, the government, it would be unable to show that this error was harmless, either beyond a reasonable doubt if the constitutional standard is applied, or even if the non-constitutional harmless error standard is applied. I see I've gone over my time, Your Honor, so if there are no further questions.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Sarah Chasson on behalf of the United States. There was nothing coercive about either the wording of the Court's anti-deadlock instruction or the circumstances under which it was given. This instruction that was given represents this Court's in-bank determination of a neutral, prophylactic statement that is appropriate to give to jurors who are wrestling with the problems that sometimes happen in juries when they cannot reach an agreement. The instruction does nothing more than tell the jurors to encourage deliberation, to consider each other's views, and to feel free to reconsider their own opinions without giving them up if they feel that they are strongly held.
Would it have made a difference if the judge had actually read the split and not been able to tell the jurors that he didn't know?
If he'd read the split to the jurors?
No, if he had actually read the note and learned of it exactly what the split was, and then could not have gone on and told the jurors, as Judge Henderson points out, that he didn't know the split. Would that make a difference?
I think there is some support in the case law for indicating that it can, under some circumstances, make a difference. I don't think that merely reading the split should make a difference if the jury is not apprised that the judge knows their split and is responding to it. If the judge takes steps, the question is, what is the effect on the jury? And I think that the judge can still know the split and nonetheless make a subsequent anti-deadlock instruction.
Well, wouldn't a jury think that the judge, if the jury sends out a note which describes a split, and the judge doesn't thereafter say what Judge Robertson said here, which is, I don't know the split, wouldn't the jury likely think that the judge had read the note?
They might, but I think that also if the judge, in response to a revealed jury split, takes steps to safeguard the minority jurors and to say, although you've revealed your split to me, I am giving you, you know, I am giving you instruction that is standard, that is sanctioned, and is not to, you are not to take that in any way as my views of how you are deliberating or how deliberations are going, that might cure it. I agree that it would be a different situation than what we have here, and I think the case law would make it closer for the government. But we don't have that here. I mean, we went, as Judge Henderson said, Judge Robertson really went overboard to make the jury feel that they had, you know, improperly violated the bounds of jury deliberations by communicating with him in that manner, and repeatedly emphasized to them that he did not know or did not want to know. I mean, at bottom, to reverse for coercion here, we have to assume that the jury disbelieved Judge Robertson, and there's no basis to think that.
Now I'm thinking, I wonder if that isn't coercive. I mean, he did really chew them out, and they go back and say, boy, he's really mad at us. We better resolve this case. Now, I know they did deliberate for at least, what, another hour and a half the next day.
Another hour and a half the next day. And also, I don't think that it is coercive what he said, because what it does is it safeguards the privacy of the deliberating jurors, which is really the concern here. And by saying you should not have told me, one could easily suppose that that would make a juror who was in the minority feel confident that their place was going to be respected and not intruded upon by the district court.
Mr. Jaffe seems to be making a somewhat different argument here, which I don't think I've actually seen in the cases before, because he's saying the fact that the foreperson talked about, you know, how this was going in open court is a factor that should be viewed as coercive.
Yes, I likewise have not seen that raised in the case law. Just as an aside, I disagree with Mr. Jaffe that the record indicates that the trial court told the jurors in open court that there was a juror refusing to deliberate. I believe that at the bottom of page 297, it indicates that that colloquy took place up at the bench when he had counsel present and said, I believe we have one juror who's refusing to deliberate. So to the extent that the court is concerned that the jury itself felt that Judge Robertson believed at least one member of the jury panel to be non-cooperative, I believe that that conversation was private. In terms of what the foreperson said, the fact that that was recounted to Judge Robertson should not make a difference here, because it's no secret to the jurors in the jury room that the foreperson or others with them disagree. So the fact that, they have asked, presumably made a decision as a group to ask for assistance, the basis for their need, the reason for their need for assistance is going to be made public, and this was nothing surprising. It's not like anybody's opinions were being made known to the other panel members for the first time in open court.
But he was attacking, or whoever the woman was, a man or woman, was attacking one of the jurors. And there's another point, and Mr. Jaffe didn't mention it, but they also wanted to meet, remember, with the jury without the counsel.
Yes.
And what's your position on how we should consider that?
My position is that it's very speculative to know what's going on, and it's difficult to know exactly. I mean, I heard you say one.
Here's my point: is the coercive nature of it. You know, we've already talked about how he chewed them out about telling them what the number was. Now they ask him at the same time, "We want to meet with you alone," and he says, "You can't do that. That's not how we do this." And what I'm thinking is the jury. The effect on the jury of his displeasure with them, first with telling them this, putting down the split, and second with wanting to meet with him outside of the, without lawyers.
I have two responses to that. The first is, this is one of those situations when a cold appellate transcript doesn't really necessarily convey what was going on. We know nothing about Judge Robertson's tone, his body demeanor. We're asking to assume then that it was in fact, I'm hearing the court say, you know, he was responding in anger. I did not necessarily get that sense from the transcript. He may not have been angry with him. He may have been emphatic, or he may have been, you know, speaking with him.
Well, I'm reading what he said to the lawyers, and I really ought to rub their nose in the instruction. I mean, he was mad at that point.
He may not have been mad when the jury came. Mindful, I mean, Judge Robertson has been doing this for many years, and I'm sure he is mindful of the need to not make the situation more coercive than it is. And the second point that I would make in response to that is that, again, it's the government's view that that would actually make the minority jurors feel better. I mean, somebody is trying to run around the panel and seek some kind of relief that, in a way, is exclusionary in some form, and the judge is insisting on adhering to practices and procedures that are designed to ensure that the verdict represents a neutral, balanced reflection of the panel of 12. And I think that Judge Robertson's response then to them is to say, no, we are not going to meet in private. There will be no secret deliberations. I am not going to know your split. You go and continue deliberating. Listen to each other. I think that that was a balanced, fair response and did nothing to add to the coercion of that is just in some ways inherent when people disagree in a small room.
Can I ask you for one moment on the Brisbane question?
Sure.
Do you have in mind what the difference is between looking at this from the point of view of plain error and looking at this merely from the point of view of sufficiency? I take it this would be plain error because...
This is plain error, yes.
There was no specific objection. There were other specific objections. So what's the difference in how we think about it because it's plain error?
Well, I think that because it's plain error, there has to... You know, it's obviously that the evidence still has to be sufficient, but under the plain error standard, I think that it would be more difficult to find a violation of substantial rights from, as how appellant argues, the government merely presented evidence through its expert witness. You know, it's...
Right, but so if we just normally think about... it does feel to me like there should be a difference, but I'm having a little difficulty thinking about what the difference is, so... Normally, sufficiency means whether any rational juror could reach this conclusion.
Yes.
And if we were to conclude that no rational juror could reach this conclusion, then what would plain error add to that?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Is there a reason why the government is resisting having chemist or somebody else testify that the material in front of him or her is smokable? I mean, ever since Brisbane, the panel's been saying, where's that evidence, and it never shows up. Why? Is there a reason why?
My only understanding of the reason why that might be is that some chemists have not performed that test, and the DEA laboratory doesn't doesn't, you know, work for the government. They perform.
Really? I thought they worked for the DEA.
They do work for the DEA, but they do not as they do not respond to specific.
If the Justice Department instructed them that they're going to start losing cases if they don't. I mean, right now, they testify as to whether cocaine base is present.
Yes.
If they weren't testifying to that, somebody from the Justice Department would say, we're going to lose our cases if you don't start telling us whether there is or isn't cocaine present.
Well, that would require the government to then require them to ask them to do additional tests.
That's
that
right.
Don't are not necessary for the government to sustain its burden of proving that it's crack cocaine here. We have to prove cocaine base and either crack or smokeability. And my understanding is that they don't regularly test for smokeability, whether we've asked them to or not, by some sort of directive at
what
a higher level than a trial
means?
System. If you asked J.J. Brennan, he would tell you that it was, if you asked Sergeant Brennan, who testified.
Yeah, I know who he is, but the question is, what would he say is the definition of crack?
He would tell you that it is the form of cocaine that is sold in a, judging from the record here, he would tell you that it is the form of crack cocaine that is in a rock-like substance
that's the
that
only,
is sold on
that's
the street.
That's the point, that it's in rock-like form. So it's cocaine base in rock-like form?
In rock-like form that is typically ingested by being smoked in
right,
common practice.
But how would he know whether it was this was the kind that, only by looking at it?
By looking at it and from his experience of looking at it. It's not like we have a novice looking at it and saying this looks like crack. We have somebody who has interviewed drug dealers, who has conducted undercover buys, and who has seen
right,
these
he knows
murders.
That some things that look like, that are rock-like, are smoked, but he obviously doesn't know that the thing in front of him is smoked.
No, he knows that crack cocaine typically is ingested by smoking.
But isn't that circular?
I think that it was with respect to Brennan himself, and it was sufficient for him to say. I think I was understanding Judge Garland's question to go, I think, a little beyond that, because Powell said that it was a good point that was being raised by the appellant, but one that they'd never required the particular testing for the sulfates and the salts that were in that.
Was Powell plain error? Or we don't actually know. Powell doesn't say one way or the other whether it was plain
error. It does not, no.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I just ask you about Mr. Lloyd's absence here?
Yes.
And whether the government makes an argument that even if he had that right, it was not prejudicial.
Yes, it is the government's view that it was not prejudicial in the slightest because his interests were ably represented by his lawyer who argued with the trial court about the wording of an anti-deadlock instruction, although ironically he asked for an anti-deadlock instruction that was in some ways more coercive than the Thomas instruction that ultimately was given. But he was represented by his lawyer throughout those proceedings who did participate.
And we know Lloyd came back.
There is an indication that at around 6 in the evening, Mr. Lloyd, 5:30 or 6, Mr. Lloyd did return to the courtroom, and then he was told by the district court that the proceedings had ended for the day. You know, it's reasonable to assume that competent defense counsel would have also kept his client apprised of what had happened during his absence, but there is no on-the-record indication that the district court actually informed Mr. Lloyd. Thank you. I would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
All right, why don't you take a minute or two?
Thank you.
You didn't mention the point about wanting to meet with him without counsel, at least not in your argument, I know.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I did want to address that. It's our position that is some indication that the majority jurors wanted the judge's assistance in helping to persuade the holdouts. I mean, that would be a fair inference from the record, and that's why they asked to meet with the judge without the lawyers present.
Why would that be the inference? Without the lawyers, what would be?
Well,
what were their absence?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, what the jurors had in mind as to why they didn't want the lawyers present. There apparently was some confusion about the role of the jury as opposed to the role of the judge, and perhaps some of the jurors thought that they could meet with the judge without the lawyers being present because of their various roles. I did want to make just a couple of other very quick points. In terms of the comment made by the judge or his conclusion that one or more jurors was refusing to deliberate, I perhaps misspoke earlier. That comment was made at the bench conference, not in open court, so the jury did not hear that. In terms of Judge Brown's question about not having seen this argument before in the cases concerning the proceedings in open court and how that might affect the coercion equation, I think one reason you don't see that in the cases is because most judges require those kinds of requests to be in a note and not made in open court, as was done here. The government argues that the other jurors knew what the split was anyway, so what difference does it make? But certainly there's another level of embarrassment or humiliation to the holdout jurors when it's done in open court with everyone present rather than just back in the jury room with only the jury there. I believe those are the only points, so if there are no further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.